Dr. Jamal.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Could we have a summary, please, of last week's program?
Okay. Last program was a continuation of surveying the state of the world at the time of the mission of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. More specifically, we reviewed briefly the state of affairs in Europe, according to H.G. Wells' description. We discussed the religious situation in Saudi Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula, and the spread of idolatry as intermediaries between man and God. We reviewed also the social situation, which was not very encouraging: drinking, adultery, usury, and fighting. But in spite of that, we indicated that there are a number of reasons why God might have chosen that particular place to send his last prophets and messenger. And in spite of the evils that existed in the Arabian Peninsula, still it was, first of all, detached from the struggle that was going on between the two superpowers of the time, the Persian and Byzantine empires. Two, it was away from the complexities of theology and philosophy that was introduced into the simple teaching of the prophets of the past in the nations around them. And as such, Islam presented a theological and political alternative to the state of the world at the time. Secondly, that in spite of the remoteness of Mecca, still it was a very important geographic and trade center, and that facilitated the spread or dissemination of the message of Islam when the Prophet was sent by God. And finally, that among the Arabs, despite of their faults, they had the characteristic of being independent. They cherished freedom a great deal, especially Central Arabia, which was away from the domination of the superpowers of the time. And once they are or were convinced and sold on some ideas or ideology, they were willing to put their life on the line in defense for it. And once those people actually became Muslims, they were the greatest defenders of Islam.
So far you spoke about the environments in which the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, came. I'd like to know, was there any anticipation of his coming in his immediate environment?
Yes, in fact, there were a number of reports that many Arabs, or some of the Arabs, used to think or anticipate a prophet to come. And they felt at that time that his coming was imminent. These expectations of theirs were, in essence, based on what they heard from learned scholars or monks or clergy among the Jews and Christians. In the very famous reference in history, At-Tabari, in his second volume, and also in another equally important reference called Tabaqat ibn Sa'd, it is said that one Arabian person before the advent of Islam, who was well known by the name of Zayd ibn Amr ibn Nufail, once said that he was anticipating a prophet to come from the descendants of Ishmael, i.e. from the Arabs, that he believes in him when he comes and accepts him as a prophet. And he says, if I don't live enough or long enough to see him myself, then you should convey my regards or my greeting of peace to him. And then he went on to give even his physical features, which we'll come to in a later program perhaps, that he will be raised in Mecca, that he will be driven away and go to Yathrib, which is now called Medina, and that he said, I went around many countries, many places, examining and looking for the religion of truth. And he said that everyone I asked among the Jews and Christians, he means perhaps the learned ones, as well as the scholars of Zoroastrianism, the religion of old Persia, all of them has given me or indicated this description that I gave, he says. Now, there are some writers who do not even mention the story of Zayd and what he mentioned prior to the birth of Prophet Muhammad or his coming. But there are other people, again, who mention the story and raise some question about its authenticity. I believe that these doubts about that story are not justifiable for a number of reasons. First of all, the story appears in two important and among the most authentic historical references, At-Tabari and Ibn Sa'd. Secondly, that those who criticized the story did not have really a very firm ground to criticize a story like that. And I would suggest that perhaps they might have not been very familiar with the provisions in the Bible about the advent of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And they might have thought that these signs are far-fetched. They are so much, consistent with the what happened later on, with the characteristics of the Prophet, that they might have thought that this was too good and too specific to be true. And I'm not referring here just to the signs in the older manuscripts of the Bible that might have been in existence in the 7th or 8th century, but rather even the copies of the Bible that we have right here in our hands. I think many of those critics, even modern ones, might have not been aware about the extent of clarity of the mention of Prophet Muhammad in the Bible, even in our hands today.
Now, I realize that this topic about Muhammad in the Bible was covered before, right. So we won't go over this extensively again. But I was wondering if you could just connect this new information which you've just given with what was conveyed, which was talked about before. Maybe briefly, if you could just form a connection.
Okay, briefly, yes, because all these were discussed, as you know, in greater detail and documented evidence. But there are a number of interesting remarks about the profile and description given by Zayd, an Arab, and what we have discussed before in the Bible. Number one, in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, we find again the prophecy about the blessing of the nations of the earth through the descendants of Ishmael, of Abraham, and the first son of Abraham, as we all know, is Ishmael. This is confirmed further in the book of Genesis in chapter 21 in verses 13 and 18, which specifies that God also will bless the son of the bondwoman, Hagar, that is Ishmael. This has been confirmed further in the 11th chapter of the book of Isaiah, when it speaks in the beginning about the great personality to come from the stem of Jesse, J-E-S-S-E. We discussed previously in detail why this is not to be taken as the father of David. And we quoted Encyclopedia Biblica under names that says Jesse is an abbreviation of Ishmael, because Ishmael in Hebrew is Yishmael, Yeshi, Jesse. That is very much consistent also with the prophecy made by Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 18, about a prophet like unto himself, who would bring also a complete code of law, who will be sent from the brethren of the Israelites, i.e. the Ishmaelites. The statement made by Zayd ibn Nufail in this new information we discussed in this program here, that he will be raised in Mecca. And that's again very consistent with the Bible in the Psalms of David in Psalm number 84, especially verses 4 to 6, which speaks about the blessed one passing through the valley of Bekka. Still, it appears as Bekka in King James Version as well as the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. So the place is not far-fetched. It has been already anticipated in the Bible. The fact that he said that he will be driven out of his country and take refuge in Medina, or as it was called, Yathrib at that time. This we discussed in one of the most fascinating prophecies in the book of Isaiah, in chapter 21, especially verses 13 through 17, that speaks about the oracles concerning Arabia, connected with Kedar, who was one of the children of Ishmael, and speaks about the migration of the persecuted people and the instruction given to the people in Timan, which is in northern Arabia, close to the vicinity of Medina, to receive those refugees. The fact that he mentioned that his name would be Ahmed or Muhammad, which are both names of the Prophet, come from the same root, praise, is very much consistent not only with the Quran in Surah 61, verse 6, but consistent as well with the prophecy made by Jesus, peace be upon him, as we discussed it in great detail in several programs, about the paraclete mentioned in the Gospel according to John in chapter 14, 15, and 16. in the prophecy or the statement made by that Arab, Zayd ibn Nufayl. He said also that there will be no prophet after him. That is, there will be no more prophet. He's the last one, basically, what he's saying. And that, again, is consistent with the statement attributed to Jesus, peace be upon him, in John in chapter 14, verse 16, that this paraclete will remain with you forever, which does not necessarily mean physically, but his law, his teaching would remain forever, because no prophet is coming to supersede what he taught. In John chapter 16, verse 12, also we discussed that in a previous program, when Jesus, peace be upon him, indicates that this paracletus is going to guide you unto all truth, which means that Jesus, like many other great prophets before him, contributed to the revelation of truth. God revealed truth through them. But the completion of truth will come only with the advent of the last prophet. And the fact that it is completed truth, it means that there is no prophet after him. So that's very much consistent in various references. The same thing we discussed in a previous series of programs, I should say, also, that the gospel, discovery of the gospel of Barnabas, revealed that Jesus actually spoke about the advent of Prophet Muhammad by name in several places. So the Quran speaks about it, the Gospel of Barnabas speaks about it, the Old Testament canonized, the New Testament canonized speak of that. So it's really fascinating to see how a report like that coming from an Arab, away from the basic centers of Judaism and Christianity, claims that he heard that from Jews and Christians, and then we find this consistent confirming references to the coming of the last prophet. It's just fascinating to me.
Are you aware of any report or any sign, any report of any sign that particular time about possibly unusual events or other markers that there was the coming of the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, events preceding his actual birth?
Yes, indeed. There are several of these reports from different sources, to the point that it is very difficult to really be objective enough by and dismiss all of them as exaggeration. For example, Abu Zahra, one of the contemporary or recent scholars from Egypt, Sheikh Muhammad Abu Zahra, in his book about the Sirah, three-volume work on the life history of the Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, quotes from a book called Al-Iktifa in the first volume about a report on a vision or dream that was seen by Abdul Muttalib, who was the grandfather of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And what he saw in his dream, Abdul Muttalib, is that a silver chain came out of his back, and then it extended, so part of it, or one side, was connected with heavens, the other one on earth. And then there was another extension, one going towards the east and the other going towards the west. And then he saw that chain all of a sudden coming closer and becoming like a tree. So each of the chains, links in the chain, became like a leaf of a tree. And from each leaf of the tree there was light coming. And then he saw people from various nations, he said from east and west, coming and hanging by that tree. When Abdul Muttalib, that was before the birth of the Prophet, saw this dream, he went to some people who have certain skill, you know, in interpreting dreams. He said, what does that really symbolize? They said, first of all, something coming out of your back, this is a symbol of somebody coming from your descent, from your lines. You know, this used to be a symbolical reference. You say somebody's coming from your back, that means, you know, a descendant of yours. That somebody will be coming from your descendants who will be praised in heavens and on earth, referring to the extension of the silver chain, whose religion or faith will spread all over the earth, so it engulfs east and west. And of course the light is a reference to the guidance, spiritual guidance that he will receive from God. And then the hanging of people from east and west in the tree is a symbol that his faith will be spread all over the world, that people from all kind of backgrounds, different races and colors, will be hanging by his tree. That is accepting and adhering to his faith. And the reality of what happened is exactly that. Those who follow, or at least claim to follow Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, represent one out of every five human beings today, East and West. You can see that when you go to Hajj, the pilgrimage, when you see all that. The praise of the Prophet in heavens by angels, the praise on earth in the Muslim daily prayers, there is always praise for God, and there is praise also for the Prophet as his servant and messenger. That was one. A second sign is reported in the very famous and the most important source about the biography of the Prophet by Ibn Hisham that we discussed before, in volume 1, pages 151 through 155. There is an interesting story that I mentioned rather briefly, which shows that the father of Prophet Muhammad, Abdullah, was in a position which in some respects resembled the position of Ishmael, the son of Abraham. The story goes like this. It says that Abdul Muttalib, that is the grandfather of the Prophet, when he started digging the well of Zamzam on a basis of a vision that he saw, actually the well of Zamzam was there, but it was covered, so he started to, you know, clear it again. At that time, Abdul Muttalib had only one son by the name of Al-Harith. But while he is digging Zamzam, the well of Zamzam, he made a covenant with God that if God gives me 10 male children and they all lived, I'm going to sacrifice one of them. I'd slaughter, kill one and sacrifice it for God. Of course, that's not approved Islamically, but that was before Islam. And then what happened is that it indeed God gave him lots of children, and he had 10 children and 6 girls, by the way, also. And the time came to fulfill his promise. So they had some people who make this divining of errors, you might say their own lottery, just to find out who by chance would be chosen. And the arrow fell on Abdullah, the father of Prophet Muhammad. That's of course before he got married, even just as a young man. So his father, very sorry, very determined also to fulfill his covenant, took Abdullah, who was the youngest and most one of the most beloved persons in Mecca at that time, was very good looking, was very good and noble person, and he started to take him to, you know, sacrifice him in his mind for the sake of God. But some people stopped. He said, Abdul Muttalib, what are you doing? He said, I have to fulfill my promise. He said, no, why don't you sacrifice animals like camels, kill camels instead of your own son? So after some arguments, and I'm just trying to abbreviate lots of details, he was advised finally to make an arrow between 10 camels or his son. So the arrow fell on his son. So he was told to increase the 10 camels to 20, and then again it fell on his son. He kept increasing successively every time he adds 10 camels, until finally the choice was between 100 camels or his son. And finally the arrow fell on the camels. So he repeated that a couple of times to make sure, and then finally he got that as a sign that he can sacrifice the 100 camels rather than slaughter his son. That's why I said, in one sense, not fully, in some sense, it may resemble the position in which Prophet Ishmael was put when God ordered Abraham to sacrifice his son Ishmael. And again, in some previous program, we discussed why we believe it was Ishmael rather than Isaac, but that's another topic anyway. So there was some similarity here, as if God also saved Ishmael so that from his descendants Prophet Muhammad will come, and save the immediate father of Muhammad, Abdullah, so that out of him Prophet Muhammad is to come. The third of four signs that just in this issue is also mentioned in the first volume of Ibn Hisham, and also in At-Tabari, that the Prophet himself, peace be upon him, has indicated that when his mother got pregnant with him, he must have heard it from her probably before her death, that a light or some light got out of her, and she was able to see the palaces in Syria. It's sort of vision that might perhaps be an indication that the light of Islam would reach those palaces in Syria, and that's what happened. Muslims conquered all the superpowers around them, and actually Islam spread there. The editors of the volume of the Ibn Hisham biography, at least the volume I have, they said there was also a similar story that happened with another Arab by the name of Khalid ibn Sa'id ibn al-As, that he also saw a similar type of vision that lighted the palaces of Syria. The fourth and final signs on, you might say, indications before his birth is also in Ibn Hisham, but also mentioned in the Quran in Surah 105. We made a brief reference to that previously in our discussion of the methodological faults of Dr. Haykal and those who followed his approach. This is the story of the elephant, very briefly again to refresh our memories, that Abraha, the king of Ethiopia at that time, built a very fancy church, and he wanted to make that as a place for pilgrimage to divert people who used to still go to the Kaaba to go to his church instead. One pagan Arab got very infuriated. Even though he was pagan, still they respected the Kaaba as the house of Abraham. So he got very angry, so he went to that church and did something very undignified, very inappropriate. So when Abraha learned of this, he got really mad, and he decided that he should go and demolish the Kaaba to remove this competition and to revenge for what happened to his church. So he came with a huge army, with elephants, and on his way there were some attempts on some Arab tribes to resist, but they could not resist this very powerful army. So they came close to Medina and to Mecca, and they started marching towards the Kaaba. The Quraysh, the tribe of the Prophet, felt that there is no way that you can resist such a huge army, especially with the elephants with them. You know, they had no experience dealing with elephants. So they went to the mountains, and then the army of Abraha started to direct the major elephant toward the Kaaba. He sat and refused to move. They kept beating him, no way. They let him stand and then direct him towards any direction he would move. But to direct him towards Kaaba, he starts, stopping and doesn't move, regardless of what they did with him. And at that time, as the Quran described in Surah 105, groups and groups of birds came from the sea carrying small stones, throwing those stones that killed and destroyed that army. Abraha himself was severely injured. And by the time he reached Sana'a, which is now in Yemen, he immediately died afterwards. Like I said, we discussed that before in the context of correcting Dr. Haykal, who tried to interpret that as smallpox or epidemic and all that. And we indicated that the evidence historically, logically, and medically shows that this is not a good explanation. And definitely there must have been something unusual, call it miracle, call it what you like, but even the adversaries of the Prophet in his lifetime could not dare deny that the report in the Quran is absolutely accurate, and it was indeed a miracle or divine intervention. Its relationship to our discussion here is that this is one more sign, as if to tell the world that the Kaaba, the first house on earth to be built for the worship of the one true God, will be preserved, because very soon, basically few weeks after that incident, the one who is going to clean or cleanse the Kaaba and restore it to monotheism will be born. And that's what happened. The Prophet was born in that year.
MashaAllah. Now, you mentioned about the signs and things preceding his birth. Were there any other signs at the time of his birth or after?
There are several. Perhaps we can touch on a couple of them as much as time allows us.
Which is too much.
Right, I just say very briefly. First of all, there's something that the Quran itself refers to in Surah 72, that when the jinn, J-I-N-N, which is unseen creatures, try to pry into the secrets of heavens as they used to do, they say they found that the skies were filled with stern guards with flaming fires. There was meteorites which were unusual and uncustomary at this time. This is not only referred to in the Quran, but it is mentioned also in the authentic source on Sirah, Ibn Hisham, in volume 1 also. A similar report is mentioned in another biography by As-Suhayli, Al-Rawd al-Unuf, and we discussed that or referred to that person before, one of the earlier writers as well. In addition to this, there were also reports of strange things that happened the night the Prophet was born. One of which was the collapse of part of the palace of the ruler or the emperor of Persia, as if to tell him that your tyrannical empire very soon is going to collapse. Another vision was seen by one of the men around the ruler of Persia, that he said, I saw in the dream camels followed by Arabian horses crossing the Tigris and Euphrates, you know, the two rivers there, Tigris and Euphrates. And while they were discussing the interpretation of that dream, which is obvious that the Arabs will be coming, or the something will come and cross the river and, you know, remove your kingdom. While they were discussing that, they received a report that the fire that Zoroastrians used to worship and has been constantly lit for 1,000 years mysteriously was extinguished. So that again seemed to have indicated that the worship of fire will disappear once Islam take hold in this place and people embrace Islam rather than fire worship. There were two more signs, perhaps we can mention this very quickly. One is that according to Ibn Hisham, a Jewish merchant also in Mecca itself, when the same night when the Prophet was born, started to ask people, did you have any child born tonight? And many were not aware. They said no. And apparently he seemed to have some kind of sign or unusual observation that led him to believe that something great happened that night, the birth of the Prophet.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Beda. We will have to pick up on this next week, inshallah. Most fascinating. And thank you all for joining us here on Islam in Focus. As always, your questions and any comments would be most appreciated. Our phone number and address would be appearing on your screen. From all of us, assalamu alaikum. Hope to see you next week, inshallah.